Welcome back to the Hydrogen Bar. Welcome back to your favorite podcast on hydrogen and fuel cells. And of course, at first, I want to say hello to my friend Johannes. Hi, Johannes.
Hello, Martin.
And we are extremely happy and honored that we still have the chance to speak with Stephen Harrison. Hello, Stephen, once again.
Hello, Martin. Hello, Johannes. Nice to be back.
Hello, Stephen. It was super interesting last time to talk about this global perspective and how the countries are developing and also like what needs to be done to kind of get these corporate investments rolling. Now, when we look into these corporate investments, we see often still a lot of discussion about technologies and which technology to go along. Like, for example, at the moment, there's this big discussion in the truck industry. Should we use liquefied hydrogen or the pressurized hydrogen? Like, what is your take on this? Are we there stuck in some theoretical discussions that kind of, hold us off on getting into the doing?
I think we run the risk of that for sure. If you'd have asked me 12 months ago, was trucking going to go compressed gaseous hydrogen or liquid hydrogen, I would have very clearly told you compressed gaseous hydrogen. Then we saw an announcement from Mercedes saying that they were going to go liquid hydrogen. And I thought, I'll be very honest with you, I thought it was an April Fool's joke. I had to check the calendar. And then I realized, no, it's not the 1st of April. Maybe they're serious about this. But I tried to ignore it. I tried to forget it. Then a couple of months later, I saw that Linde had made a partnership with Mercedes-Benz to develop liquid hydrogen infrastructure for refueling. And I thought, well, I can't ignore it now. That's my former employer, Linde Gas. They, they kind of know what they're doing, I think.
Obviously.
These Mercedes people, I don't know them so well. But Linde, well, I do trust them a bit. And if they're getting into this, then there must be something here. And then 2 months later, I see another announcement saying that the South Koreans have invested XYZ, million won on developing a liquid hydrogen fueling station infrastructure. So then I'm kind of going, there's something here. And now, yes, you're absolutely right. We've got a two-horse race. Will it be one? Will it be the other? And I think I have mixed feelings on these topics. And this is just one example of the point that you're alluding to here. Should we analyze? Should we procrastinate? Should we optimize? Should we wait for the perfect solution? Or should we just go? Mm. And, I'm very ambitious. I'm very aggressive. I just want to do stuff a lot of the time, and I'm happy just to go. Some other people have a different type of nature and a different type of character. They want to sit back. They want to analyze. They want to look at the best solutions. And 3 or 4 years later, maybe they make a decision that's ultimately better than the one that I would have made. But, we've lost 3 or 4 years in the meantime. Mm-hmm. But what I feel good about, Martin, what I feel good about, Johannes, is that whilst, yes, there's a good debate taking place between, battery electric vehicle versus hydrogen. There's a strong debate, even for trucking. Liquid hydrogen versus gaseous hydrogen, 350 bar versus 700 bar. Yes, there are some very, very worthy debates taking place. But what I feel encouraged about is that in addition to us asking the question, what's the right thing to do, we are getting on and doing things. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes me feel good. We're not just waiting for the answer and then doing it. We're actually doing things in parallel.
In parallel, yeah.
People are taking the risk. People are saying, okay, well, do you know what? It might be liquid or it might be gas, but I'm just going to do it anyway. I'm going to go this way and make a decision, do something. And I feel very, very positive about that.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there's always the risk when you do things in parallel that you are doing things like double investments and that you are just kind of burning money that you would have rather spent for or the other technique or the other technology. But you are still positive about all of these technologies evolving in a parallel, or do you also see the risk that there is huge amounts of money just thrown out the window and not spent for the right technology, if you will?
I do see that risk, and I do recognize that risk. And I'm sure that a lot of investors and infrastructure investors or people thinking about R&D programs for their trucks or whatever, I'm sure they're also very, very concerned about those risks. On the other hand, the risk of doing nothing is even greater. Mm-hmm. Every year that we wait, that's more CO2 emissions going into the air. You know, every year that we wait, that target of 2030, 2040, 2050 net zero, those targets get closer and closer and closer. And yes, you know, there's a financial risk here at stake. Of course there is. We might invest in technologies or infrastructure that ultimately we then throw away, or it only has a short life. We end up looking at stranded assets. Nobody wants that. That's not the plan, but it might happen. But what's the alternative? The alternative is to wait, sit on your hands and do nothing until the whole world is certain and the whole world is clear. And I'll tell you what, that will end up with one certainty and only one certainty, and that is increased global warming, and you know, we all fry.
That's definitely an invalid point, but isn't there then the question, like, how do we get kind of the industry rolling, right? Like, because I understand every kind of CEO who says, oh, I'm here for 5 years, I don't care about this global warming, I don't want to invest in the wrong technology. Do you think there is more guidance from governments needed, that they say, this is how we do it? Like, we pay for the refueling infrastructure, and kind of that the governments take over part of this risk?
In my opinion, no, I don't think that is the right approach. Maybe other people would have a different view, and that's absolutely fine. But the way that I see legislation being written is often technology agnostic, as it would be referred to. Yeah. And I think that's absolutely fine. I think, you know, the government and the politicians would often say, you know, the market will sort out what the best technological solution is. Let's let the market optimize, you know, the technology. Let's let the market optimize the economics of this. We will set a policy framework to stimulate change. And, you know, I'll be very honest, I think that's okay. I mean, I've been reading environmental legislation and working with environmental legislation and understanding, let's say, the business implications or the investment implications of environmental legislation for the last 20 years. You know, whilst I was working at Linde, it was all about emissions pollution control legislation, NOx emissions control, SO2 emissions control, automotive emissions control, Euro 3, Euro 4, Euro 5, Euro 6, understanding the industrial emissions directive and the investment implications of that and all the different breath notes. So I have a lot of, let's say, experience of how difficult it is for the politicians to write good legislation. You know, I've often been involved in the consultation. I understand how difficult it is to write perfect legislation. But I do believe that setting the framework, having a light touch at the legislative end, and then letting, you know, the people who really know what they're doing, you know, industry, the experts, the technology experts, optimize that right technological solution. I see that as being the right way to go. Yes, there will be stranded assets. Yes, there will be wasted investments. But that has been the case right throughout history. Mm-hmm. You know, just think back to, maybe you're not old enough to remember this, but I'm 52 years old now. And I remember when video recorders were being invented when I was a child. Even video recorders, they don't exist anymore now, do they at all? But, you know, people used to watch videos on video cassettes, and there was a big battle between VHS and Betamax, and when the two different technological protocols were launched. And Betamax, people said, had the better technology. Well, maybe they did have the better technology, but ultimately VHS became a single standard solution. You look at what's happened with search engines. And okay, Firefox, I actually like to use Firefox, and I know some people, you know, like to use Microsoft Edge and whatever, but fundamentally, Google Chrome, Google is the default solution for a lot of people. I mean, to Google something is now a verb, isn't it? It's not a single channel. There are other alternatives, of course, but it is extremely dominant. And, you know, the world does favor these kinds of sort of, let's say, single technology or single channel solutions. And, you know, somebody, you know, Yahoo or whatever, Bing, you know, all of these search engines that, you know, 20 years ago were emerging and, you know, 5 years after they got started all shrunk away and you're left with, you know, really just Google as the search engine solution. You know, we can see similar things happening with hydrogen. But again, I'd make the point that some level of technological risk, some level of technological obsolescence, some level of invested money or infrastructure that is ultimately ripped apart and thrown away because it was wrong. These things happen all of the time in every single, let's say, technology or innovation that the world has ever encountered. This is what has happened. So yes, of course, it's right to worry about it. It's right to try and find the right solution. It's right to minimize risk, but it's not right to do nothing.
Yeah. I see. Now, we have talked a lot about global warming, which is, of course, mainly caused by greenhouse gas emissions. What we have not talked so much about in the podcast yet is carbon capture and storage, CCS. In fact, we have barely touched this topic, I think. We have mentioned a few times, but not in too much detail. And now the fortunate situation is that you're an expert on CCS technology. So what can you tell us about the current status of carbon capture and storage? You have mentioned at the beginning of last week's episode that it's not a new technology. We've been talking about CCS for more than a decade, actually. What is the current status of this technology? Will this finally be able, like, scale up and become relevant?
Sure. This is the hydrogen bar, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's draw a very, very clear link between carbon capture and storage and hydrogen. When we want to make green hydrogen, we're talking about making hydrogen from a renewable source. It could be from biomethane or it could be from renewable electricity. That's green hydrogen. When we talk about making blue hydrogen, which is another form of low carbon hydrogen, we start with a fossil fuel. We convert, let's say, natural gas to hydrogen, we get CO2 emissions, and we capture those and we store them underground. So CCS is absolutely fundamental for the production of blue hydrogen. So when we want to bring CCS or CCUS or CCTS, carbon capture transportation and storage, carbon capture utilization, if we want to talk about CO2 capture, it is absolutely fundamental to enabling blue hydrogen and to enabling blue hydrogen to be part of the you know, decarbonized energy future. Carbon capture and storage is much more significantly established and advanced than many people might understand. And if we look at the European arena as just one example, and then we can go to some other nations and parts of the world, but let's start with Europe. Equinor, which is the Norwegian big oil and gas company, when they were Statoil 25 years ago, the Norwegian state oil company, implemented the first CCS scheme in Europe 25 years ago. Not 10 years ago, 25 years ago. The Sleipnerfest oil and gas field is used for carbon capture and storage. I think it was around about 12 years ago, Equinor, or Statoil, I think, as they might have still been at that time, implemented their second CCS scheme in the North Sea, which is from their Hammerfest LNG terminal inside of the Arctic Circle, where to produce energy for the liquefaction of natural gas, there's a very, very big gas turbine which burns a lot of natural gas as well to create energy for the process. And the CO2 emissions from that are also sequestered or stored under the North Sea. Why did Equinor take the lead in Europe? One very simple reason. Norway, for many, many, many years, operating outside of the European Union and operating outside of all of the rules of the European Union, implemented their own taxation policies that said every single ton of carbon dioxide that you're going to put into the air is going to cost you money.
Mm.
And that applied to Statoil, just like it applied to every other company in Norway. So for Statoil, it was a very, very simple economic decision. We either pay lots of money in tax, or we invest in carbon capture and storage, and we put this CO2 underneath the ocean floor in permanent underground storage. And that's why Norway, Statoil, Equinor now has 25 years more experience of doing this than any other nation in Europe. But you look at what could happen next. You know, the Netherlands could do exactly the same. The Groningen gas field off the northwest coast of the Netherlands is almost depleted. It's the most incredibly large CO2 storage reservoir that you know that they could use to store CO2 emissions from the Netherlands, or also perhaps also from Germany. You know, with a pipeline taking the CO2 there. The United Kingdom. Again, these nations that have oil and gas experience on the North Sea and you know, own various different sectors of the North Sea, the United Kingdom also has fantastic potential to do carbon capture and storage on some of the older gas field in the southern sector of the North Sea, for example. And you look at what they're planning to do with a project called Zero Carbon Humber. And there's a similar project in Teesside, two of the United Kingdom's biggest industrial clusters. And, you know, there's tremendous plans also for the Acorn project up in Scotland, using the old St. Fergus gas terminal at Peterhead to repurpose a lot of infrastructure for carbon capture and storage. So CCS is perhaps much further ahead than people think. There are 24 operational schemes around the world, 24. Some of those are linked to enhanced oil recovery in the United States, but a lot of them are simply underground storage. You look at the Gorgon gas field in off the west coast of Australia, and that's kind of been an on-off scheme. It's one of the biggest schemes in the world. It's also been one of the world's most troubled schemes in terms of you know, working or not working. You know, but Australia, that's only one of several schemes that exists in that part of the world, and the Australians are planning other big schemes such as the Carbon Net scheme, which will use underground storage off the Bass Strait, which is that piece of water between Victoria in southeastern Australia and Tasmania. And we'll capture CO2 from, you know, the J-Power gasification facility, which will be gasifying brown coal to make hydrogen. And the CO2 emissions from that brown coal gasification in the Latrobe Valley will be captured and stored permanently under the ground to make what I refer to as purple hydrogen, not blue hydrogen, you know, natural gas or methane with carbon capture and storage, but coal gasification with carbon capture and storage. Again, so there's a link to you between hydrogen production, low carbon hydrogen production, and carbon capture and storage.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk with people about this CCS, carbon capture and storage, often there are two topics coming up more. Is one is maybe more emotional, the other more technical. One is it's so super dangerous if you have such a kind of huge amount of CO2 underground, and then one day there's a leak and the CO2 comes out, and then it kind of, because it's more heavy than air, it stays on the ground and basically we all die. And the other thing that is often told is that there are very big problems with this CO2 corrosion, especially if you then use pipelines to bring the CO2 from, I don't know, Germany to the Netherlands to pump it there into an into such a gas field. Can you debunk this myth, or is there some truth to both of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, can I debunk these myths in the space of 2 minutes? I doubt it very much. And, you know, sometimes if it's an emotional concern, then no amount of logic or rational argument is going to change people's minds. If it's fear that we're dealing with, then, you know, listening to a podcast for 2 minutes is unlikely to really move people. But let's look at some of the science. You know, when we think about oil and gas exploration, you know, we drill a hole in the ground and up comes natural gas. What is natural gas? Well, there's a lot of methane in there. There's also some propane or some other butane. Those are called condensates. And there's also carbon dioxide in it. And some of the natural gas reserves in East Asia, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Philippines contain around about 40 or 50% of carbon dioxide. Some of the Australian natural gas sources, you know, for example, this is the reason, you know, why we've got Gorgon Gas field, you know, West Coast Australia being a massive CO2 scheme. A lot of the natural gas sources in Australia contain huge amounts of carbon dioxide also. My point here being, what exists under the ground today is a mixture of carbon dioxide and methane. We bring it up, we use the methane, we put the carbon dioxide back underneath the ground. I mean, from a geological perspective, from a looking after Mother Nature perspective, we suck out the natural gas, we use the methane, and we give Mother Nature the carbon dioxide back. That's where a lot of the carbon dioxide came from in the first place. I personally don't have an ethical or a scientific concern putting that CO2 back underneath the ground. I think it makes incredibly good sense. Other people will have a different view, and that's absolutely okay. You know, we need ethical debate as well as scientific debate. Whether we're talking about medicine, whether we're talking about politics, you know, there's an economic dimension. There's a social dimension, there's an ethical dimension. We cannot ignore the safety dimension, the environmental dimension. We cannot ignore any single dimension when we look at a debate. Science is important. I think science is important. I also think public opinion is important. I also think ethics is important. I never make an assumption that science is the leading, guiding virtue, if you like. I think we have to look across all of these and take public concerns very, very seriously. What's to say that science has the right answer? Sometimes science has been incredibly wrong or incredibly misguided in some of the things that it's chosen to do in history. And public opinion perhaps has been right. Maybe on this occasion, it's the same again. So for us to assume that the science says it should be this and public opinion says it's that, I think we should listen to all sides of the debate. But the other thing I would also say is we can't sit on our hands and do nothing. We need to get on with decarbonisation. And if it's not going to be underground carbon capture and storage, then what's it going to be? Maybe it's going to be mineralisation, conversion of CO2 to mineral salts. Fine. Maybe it's going to be other technologies, but we can't do nothing whilst we're debating these things. We have to get on and do something. But let me take the other point that you raised there with regard to CO2 safety and CO2 pipelines. You know, for example, in Germany, there is no legislation that permits underground storage of CO2 here in Germany. We can't operate a CCS scheme here in Germany. There's no legislation that permits it. So any power plant or oil refinery or chemicals work or steel plant in Germany that wants to capture CO2 emissions, they will need to transport those CO2 emissions to somewhere else. Maybe it's Norway, maybe it's the Netherlands, maybe it's Denmark, I don't really know. And say, you know, dear our friends in the Netherlands, please can you bury this CO2, you know, under the ocean for us in the North Sea? Thank you very much. We'll do that for you. But of course, we need a pipeline of CO2 to move the CO2 from Hamburg to Rotterdam or from, you know, Munich to Antwerp or wherever it's going to be injected into the North Sea or underneath the North Sea, I should say. And those pipelines, you know, how are we going to build them to make sure that they are safe, to make sure that they don't corrode? And, you know, the answer is very, very clear. Yes, carbon dioxide and water together. And that's the important thing to remember. Carbon dioxide and water together will corrode steel pipelines. That is very true. And if we get pitting and corrosion, we get weaknesses, you know, we could get explosions. And you can go onto YouTube and watch some sensational and scary videos of CO2 pipelines blowing up. Yeah, great, go and do it. It's going to make you feel terrified. What do we do? What do we do to make sure that that will never, ever, ever happen? What do we do? What we do is that we remove moisture. We remove water from the carbon dioxide very, very, very rigorously, very, very, very carefully before we put that CO2, before we put that carbon dioxide into the pipeline. So most carbon capture and storage schemes are planned to operate with CO2 as a supercritical fluid, or some people will call it a dense phase fluid. So that means beyond 80 bar, maybe 80 bar, 90 bar, 100 bar, 120 bar or whatever. But the CO2, it's not a liquid, it's not a gas, it's a supercritical fluid, sort of a soup. So halfway between a liquid and a gas, this supercritical soup. And in order to compress the CO2 up to that incredibly high pressure, let's say 80 bar, we need a big, beefy compressor. And let's say it's an 8-stage compressor. Let's say from Man Energy in here in Germany, they do the most incredibly wonderful 8-stage CO2 compressors for carbon capture and storage schemes. Each stage of that compressor has an intercooler and a condenser to remove water from the CO2. Mm. You can also integrate an MEG wash, a dryer system, to remove any other residual traces of the water from the CO2. Mm. So after that compressor, what you've got is incredibly dry, high-pressure CO2. And you put that into the pipeline, and the pipeline is not going to corrode. Because the problem is not carbon dioxide. The problem is carbon dioxide plus water.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, you know, once we've compressed it and we've dried it and we put it into the pipeline, we don't just stop there and assume that everything's okay. No, that's not enough. We will have sophisticated pipeline monitoring systems, pipeline integrity systems that are analyzing for moisture or analyzing for air ingress or analyzing for any other kind of problem that there might be on the pipeline. We don't just do it and hope that everything's okay. That's not enough. And that's not how engineering and technology works. Mm-hmm. That's not how responsible CO2 operators work either. Pipeline integrity monitoring is incredibly well established. All of the natural gas distribution and transmission pipelines that we have in Europe and the United States, everywhere else around the world, we have the most incredibly sophisticated pipeline integrity monitoring on them to measure for oxygen ingress, to measure for air ingress, to measure for leaks. We're great at doing this. We know exactly how to do this. And we can transfer all of that experience and expertise and knowledge from natural gas transmission pipelines. We can transfer that to CO2 pipelines and, by the way, also hydrogen pipelines to make sure that the infrastructure we build is safe and to make sure that we don't experience those problems that you described as some of the concerns. They are relevant concerns, but for every relevant concern, there is a scientific and a technological mitigation that is able to, I say, completely de-risk these processes is an exaggeration, but to reduce the risk in these processes to a very, very, very acceptable level. That means that going out for a walk and crossing the road is ultimately significantly more dangerous than operating a carbon dioxide pipeline. Mm. We can never eliminate risk, but we can reduce it to such a level that we say this is an absolutely, totally acceptable level of technological risk.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Now, you have just explained that all of these are public concerns regarding CCS and also regarding hydrogen, of course, or there's also a huge amount of public concerns about high pressure hydrogen and how dangerous it is and so on. You just said that all of these concerns can be addressed from a technological point of view. But on the other hand, I think we have to admit that in public communication, it's very difficult, or it's almost seems to be impossible to address these concerns in a simple and easy way. We've seen that also in the COVID crisis, that we had scientists and quite a lot of experts explaining how we should behave and what we should avoid and what measures would be needed to keep the effects as low as or as small as possible. But you see that in reality, it's very hard for us to follow science and to follow the arguments that are provided by science. Do you have a tip or a hint on how we could maybe improve the communication from the technological point of view or from the scientific point of view towards the public.
Thank you. I think empathy is absolutely critical here. Mm-hmm. And fear is an emotion. Mm-hmm. And emotions don't respond well to logic and rational argument. Mm-hmm. So to conquer or to try to conquer people's fear with science is using the wrong weapon to, you know, attack the problem. The only way to conquer fear, which is an emotion, is through empathy. And empathy is an emotional response to an emotional situation that says, yes, this could be scary. Mm-hmm. Yes, we recognize that people are afraid. And we can't respond to that with, you know, beating them over the head with scientific arguments and data and saying, you must love this because science says it's great. Excuse me, that's the exact opposite of what we should be doing. We should be saying, yes, we do remember the Hindenburg. Mm. Yes, the Hindenburg did explode and there were terrifying photographs and it put people off hydrogen. It put people off using airships forever, basically. Mm. We recognize that these things are real. And we can't take away, you know, your fear by simply saying, stop being afraid. Fear doesn't work like that. Human emotions do not work like that. And I think empathy is really required. And sometimes scientists are their own worst enemy when it comes to communicating. Sometimes politicians or celebrities or actors do an infinitely better job of trying to get the message across for us. And I think, you know, if I had to give any advice to any, you know, technical organization or whatever in terms of trying to communicate hydrogen and make hydrogen cuddly or friendly or safe, then I would say, you know, please try and engage the services of some communications professionals, advertising agencies, people who understand that communication is about engaging an emotion as well as, you know, communicating scientific facts. Try and get some influential people who are not politicians on your side to try and communicate the message. The message shouldn't always be coming from the National Hydrogen Institute or the National Ministry of Technology. No, it should be coming from people, you know, who the public know and trust, you know, actors or, you know, sports celebrities who they can really engage with. Who, you know, if they believe the message.
Hydrogen podcasts, for example.
Hydrogen podcasts, absolutely. The hydrogen bar. But I mean, so I think, but what I would say, I mean, having said all of that, what I would say is, I don't know if you have ever had the chance to interview Antoine Abou, and if you do get the chance to interview him, please do, and get him on the hydrogen bar for sure.
Okay.
But Antoine, he stayed with me in my house approximately 2 weeks ago. He's doing something called Cycling for Planet. He's cycling 10,000 kilometers, 10,000 kilometers, that's a six-month bike ride through Europe and North Africa to promote hydrogen, to speak to people who are working with hydrogen, which is why he came to visit me. My firm SBH4 and, you know, the work that I do is all related to hydrogen. So he came to talk to me, just like you're talking to me. I do hydrogen. People want to talk to me about hydrogen. That's super. But Antoine, as he's traveling around, he asks people, what do you know about hydrogen? And he said it's very, very clear. He gets three answers, and it's approximately one-third, one-third, one-third. Uh-huh. One third of people say hydrogen is the future. It's super. We've got to go with hydrogen. That's one third of what people say, the general public. One third of people say, excuse me, what did you just say? Hydro what? One third of people, it's, I have no idea what you're talking about. Hydrogen, what on earth is that going to do for the world? So one third of the people, I'm in. One third of the people, what's that? And the other third of the people, hydrogen's dangerous. Yeah. And he says it's equal thirds. And I can fully appreciate that and understand that. And the first question that I often ask, let's say politicians, when I'm dealing with politicians and people who are able to influence or engage with public opinion on hydrogen, or when I'm dealing with members of the public, the first question I ask is I will say, okay, how safe does hydrogen need to be? And the best answer that I think I've heard, and somebody gave this answer to me, it wasn't my own words, this is an answer that somebody gave to me, is they said, well, it needs to be as safe or safer than the most obvious alternative that we've used in the past. And for me, you know, does it need to be safer than cold water and drinking water? Well, that's not really an alternative, is it? You know, drinking water is different to an energy gas.
Yeah.
I think for me, the most obvious thing that we've had like hydrogen in the past is natural gas, methane. And we've got a natural gas distribution and transmission infrastructure across Europe. And, you know, if you ask people, oh, is natural gas transmission scary? Most people are going to go, I never really thought about it. Is it scary? No, I don't think so. Did you know that natural gas can explode? Oh, can it? Oh, I didn't know that. I like to use it in my house. It keeps my house warm. Did you know it can burn and explode and a pipeline can explode? Oh, well, and now that you come to mention it, that sounds pretty scary. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of conversation you'd have about natural gas. And one of the issues here, or what we're really talking about, and again, this comes back to the emotional response of a human being. We're all human beings, and don't try and take it away from us. We're human beings. That's what we are. And it's great to be a human being. But one of the things that we experience as human beings is something called risk desensitization. The longer we are exposed to a risk, the less afraid of it we are. And I'll give you a fantastic example. A lot of the time when I go to a petrol station, I see people using their cell phone. And I would love to say to them, excuse me, do you realize that what you're doing there is absolutely insane? You know, that could cause a fire right next to your head. Do you want your head to explode? And they kind of go, well, I've never actually said it to somebody, but, you know, I can imagine them going, oh, well, you know, it's just a petrol station. It's just my cell phone. You know, my girlfriend phoned me and, you know, I wanted to tell her I'm coming home late from work. Why do we do these insanely unsafe things? Well, it's called risk desensitization. Why do we not talk about the risks of natural gas or the risks of natural gas pipelines or the risks of petrol or diesel? Why do we not talk about these risks? The answer is risk desensitization. We've been handling diesel or gasoline or natural gas for the last 30, 40, 50 years. We've come to the point that we have forgotten that it's unsafe or that it could be unsafe. Hydrogen is new. It's another way of saying it in English. We often say fear of the unknown. And hydrogen is all about fear of the unknown. And that risk desensitization is the scientific way of talking about fear of the unknown. You know, so you're asking me, you know, tips for politicians and whatever. On the one hand, you know, try and communicate in a way that is empathetic. Try and communicate through channels that the general public can relate to, not just scientific channels that engineers and technical people can understand and relate to. And the other thing is, please be patient. Please be patient. Desensitization of risk. Things will change.
That was now a very positive ending note, I would say. Again, we are already above our initially given time. Thank you very much, Stephen. Do you have anything else you want to like give us on our way or give on the way of our listeners?
Stay positive. Stay engaged. Work for the solutions. Yes, see the problems, but work for the solutions. We will find a way if we do this together. Martin, Johannes, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It was very nice and extremely exciting speaking with you. Thank you very much. Keep up the excellent work, Stephen. It's a pleasure to follow you on LinkedIn and in other media. You're publishing a lot of articles, magazines, which are all fun and interesting to read. So, oh, thank you very much for your contribution to the hydrogen industry. We hope we'll have the chance to speak with you sometime in the future again.
Thank you both.
Thank you a lot. Yeah, for every one of our listeners, if you want to get in contact with us or also you want to get in contact with Stephen, feel free to reach us via our website, hydrogenbar.net. And with this, we thank you all and see you next week then.
Goodbye.